Even more than any of his critics, it is Grant Wood himself who has hampered our full understanding of his art and its motivations. Throughout his life, he attempted to present himself and his work as the reflection of authentic American manhood, conceived as heterosexual, hardworking, wholesome, and patriotic, precisely because he believed he had fallen short of this model himself.
Grant Wood painted American Gothic, one of the most famous of all American paintings, and perhaps one of the most ambiguous. What does his life tell us about the meaning of that and his many other paintings? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
The Iowa-born painter created images of the American heartland, but were they images expressing approval or disapproval of their subjects? Where did his distinctive, rather haunting style come from? And how has his reputation held up in the 21st century? Our guest is Tripp Evans, professor of art history at Wheaton College and the author of the new biography, Grant Wood, A Life, published by Knopf in 2010. And I should add before we get started that if you'd like to see some of the visuals we'll be talking about, you can go to our website, WPR.org, and follow the links.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
You mentioned in your book about Grant Wood that American Gothic is sort of like the American Mona Lisa. It is so recognizable, so frequently parodied. It really has a unique place in art history, doesn't it, that painting?
It does. And it has from the very moment it was first shown. It's not the kind of painting that grew slowly over the years into its reputation and its fame. It was famous quite literally almost overnight. And this unknown Iowa painter who had exhibited at the same show at the Art Institute of Chicago the year before was suddenly being written about in papers as far as New York, in Berlin, London. The painting was reproduced everywhere. And it seems never to have slackened. It's recognizability is something that I think has a lot to do with how mysterious it is and how people aren't quite sure what it is that they're looking at.
It's a little like the Mona Lisa that way, isn't it? You're not sure what her smile means.
Exactly, or her lack of a smile in this case.
In this case, you've got this couple and a pitchfork and kind of stylized architecture behind them.
The thing that has stymied people from the beginning, and this was something that Wood had to deal with in interviews almost the week that it was shown for the first time, was what is the relationship between these two people? Everyone assumed it was a married couple, that they were an Iowa farm couple, husband and wife. Wood initially did not contradict that. All he said was they're not necessarily from Iowa. They could be from anywhere. It was a little bit later that he began to insist that they were a father and daughter, which still people take it for a married couple. But even he flip-flopped sometimes in later interviews and referred to them as, you know, the husband or the wife. And the reason behind that is that his original model for this was his mother, who would have been a much more age-appropriate model for the pairing. His sister ends up standing in place. And so it does become this complicated thing, I think, especially for Wood. Is it his mother? Is it his sister? Is she a daughter? And so he appeared sometimes, I think, as confused as the public was.
And then the man was the dentist, apparently?
The man was Byron McKeeby, who was Wood's dentist. And he sort of fulfills the role that Wood originally saw these characters playing. His original intention for American Gothic was to portray two people who looked kind of like this Victorian farmhouse that he'd found in Eldon, Iowa. He loved the Gothic window on this house. So he had told the Des Moines Register, I just want to find two people who look like an American Gothic house. And he had originally planned to pair it with a mission version, a mission bungalow house with a mission bungalow couple in front of that house. He never did the second painting. But this was his initial intent. And like so many of his paintings, his initial intent kind of gets away from him. His inner machinery, his family dynamics start working. And I argue in the book, and I'm certainly not the first to do this, that Byron McKeeby is really a stunt double. He's Wood's father. And Wood's father died when Wood was 10. So this is Wood's attempt, and one of many, I should add, to paint his father's portrait. He never painted a straightforward portrait of his father, ever. Actually, that's not true. In one case, he painted a family scene in which his father's back is to the viewer. So all we see is the father's back. But he painted his father's portrait, I think, through these surrogates. And as he lay dying in 1942, his last dying wish was to paint his father. He could never bring himself to do it. But, of course, he'd been doing it for over, 20 years.
Well, thereby hangs a tale. I'm not sure if we'll ever be able to get the complete story, but let's take him back to 1891, mm-hmm. the origins of Grant Wood in eastern Iowa.
Anamosa, Iowa. Yep.
And his father seems to have been a very complicated man.
He was. His father was a strict Quaker. He was a very hardworking farmer. He comes across in Wood's writings, Wood's unfinished autobiography, Return from Bohemia, as a bit of a tyrant, was very stern with his three sons. Wood had an older brother and a younger brother and a much younger sister, Nan, who's the model for American Gothic. But the father really was very strict about certain things. For example, he banned fiction from the home, any kind of fairy tales or children's literature. He saw it as sinful. And in that, we begin to see a little bit of Wood's sense of kind of shame that he almost attaches to fantasy in terms of his paintings. So the father would routinely lock him in the basement. There was a lot of corporal punishment, followed weirdly by recitations of Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which would be read aloud to him.
Well, there's plenty to read from there.
Exactly. So he was a tough man. I think Wood adored him, but from a distance. And when he dies suddenly, when Wood is 10, he never gets over it. It's like a moment in his life he can never quite get past.
Can you talk about the father's concept of manhood, masculinity, and how that affected Grant?
His father really believed in hard physical labor as the source of what he believed to be sort of true manhood. In addition to that, I think strict religious piety was also very important to him. He was eulogized in the Anamosa Eureka in these, sort of unbelievable superlatives. He was the manliest of men. This is Wood's father, was the manliest of men. His library only included manly books. He had a manly brow. And I think that this set up a really almost an impossible model for Wood. He really believed that unless he became like his father, like a hardworking, pious farmer, that he had somehow failed in his father's expectations. And because he loses his father so early, he really spends, I think, the rest of his life trying to make it up to his dad.
Was he really named after General U.S. Grant?
That is the family story, that he was named for General Grant and also for his mother's – his middle name is DeVolson, for his mother's father. So from literally his naming, masculine expectations were rather high for him, as they were for so many boys in his generation. It's been written about a lot by Anthony Rotundo and others that – in the 1890s, you see this incredible intensification around an anxiety around the raising of boys. Are we raising masculine boys? What can we do to sort of re-masculinize children? And so boys start being put in adult pants. Their hair is cut short. A generation before, children have been dressed very androgynously. And so Wood is sort of part of that. It's this, it's a kind of perfect storm of masculine expectations between his father, his region, and I think kind of American culture.
There are stories of boys who have parents, fathers, who raised them that way under these strict circumstances, especially with a masculine expectation. But often the mother proves a tempering force, maybe even a force for sanity. What role did Grant Wood's mother play in the development of Grant Wood? And also, how did the brothers fare in all of this?
Well, it's interesting. I'll address the brothers first because they're actually relatively easily dispatched with. Frank the older and Jack the younger play almost no part in Wood's autobiography. You rarely hear anything about them, and they sort of disappear from the scene. It's all about Nan, the sister, Grant Wood, and his mother. His mother nurtured Wood's artistic strivings very early on, and he talks often about his first, he calls it his first studio, under the kitchen table. Because his father disapproved of his drawing activities, his mother actually hid him beneath the kitchen table, which was where he drew, there and in the cellar. When his father would banish him there, he talks about his first drawings in the cellar. So Hattie plays, his mother was named Hattie, Hattie plays a central role in his early development as an artist. She introduces him to gardening and the seasons and a kind of love of the land. He talks about this. And after his father's death, he embarks on what can only be described as a very complicated relationship with his mother. He becomes her emotional mainstay, eventually her financial mainstay. And they share a home until her death at 77. And in fact, for most of those years, they sleep in beds alongside one another. I mean, his contemporaries saw it almost as a relationship that was too close. But he adored his mother. But it was probably the most important relationship in his life.
And what about his sister, Nan?
Nan referred to that circuit of Hattie, Grant, and herself as we three. They were bound together from the time that she is 18 and returns from her older brother's house where she'd been living. She moves back in with her brother and her mother, and they remain kind of very tightly knit little circuit. In fact, she squeezed in on her own pull-out bed between Mama and Wood for many of those years, even after her marriage. She marries in 1924, and soon thereafter her husband went to a sanatorium for tuberculosis. She moves back in with her mother and her brother. And, you know, her relationship with Wood is sister, she is daughter. He's effectively a kind of surrogate father to her. Sometimes she is mother to him as well. And she fiercely defended him after his death. From 1942 until her own death in 1990, it was Nan who really controlled Wood's image. So that was after the mother, probably his closest relationship.
How often did his mother and Nan pose for him? How often were they subjects of his paintings?
Well, Nan loved posing for him. His mother hated posing for him. So the mother posed really only for her portrait, which is simply called Woman with Plants, in 1929. It's one of the first mature style works that Wood completed. Nan posed for three in around the same time period, a giant stained glass window for the Veterans Memorial Building in Cedar Rapids. She plays the mourning figure of the Republic with six dead soldiers beneath her. American Gothic, of course, and Portrait of Nan. When he finished Portrait of Nan, he told her, "It is the last time I will paint you, and it is the last time I will paint a family portrait." And she was deeply disappointed. I think she relished her kind of reflected fame by being his muse. And in fact, this really became sort of her reason for being after his death. She became the living model for American Gothic. And in fact, that is the very first time I ever saw Nan when I was in eighth grade. I saw her on Entertainment Tonight being interviewed as the living model from American Gothic. And it was really my first brush with Grant Wood. Hmm. It was Nan sort of playing that role.
I'm intrigued that he would just say arbitrarily. I mean, it seems to us arbitrary, "This is the last time I'll paint a family member."
Well, I think he believed that he had exposed his family to ridicule by certain critics. So when American Gothic came out, there were an awful lot of people who saw in it an unkind caricature of regional types. People who did not know Nan were publishing editorials and letters and critiques of this ugly spinster. They called her the missing link in one of the reviews. And it really stung her. And Wood felt that he had uncomfortably exposed his sister to harm. So when he paints Portrait of Nan in 1931, which is here at the Chazen, so wonderful. It's a lovely portrait of his sister. And it was intended as a kind of apology for the way that he had portrayed her in American Gothic. It comes out and the knee-jerk reaction is, "Well, here's another example of an unattractive, ignorant, country rube." And so I think it's partly because that kept happening. He thought, enough. I'll choose other models. You know, I don't think he wanted to expose them in that way.
And what were the influences on him when he did start working as an artist? What art was he kind of responding to?
Well, the story that a lot of people don't know about Grant Wood, and that really surprised me when I sort of started getting into his work, is that he started out as an impressionist. For over 2 decades, he painted in a very accomplished impressionist mode, very loose, lots of sort of plein air sketches. He lived in Paris off and on in the 20s. He adored being abroad and sort of being a part of the expat community in Paris. He has a kind of epiphany in 1928 when he's in Germany. He visits the Alte Pinakothek galleries in Munich, and it's like a light bulb goes off for him. He suddenly kind of sees in these 16th century Flemish and Netherlandish altarpieces a way to transform himself. I also suspect that he believed that Impressionism had become a dead end for him at that point. He was exhibiting and exhibiting and exhibiting, and there were many great Impressionist painters by, you know, the 1920s. It was almost a conservative mode of painting. So when he comes back from Germany and paints his mother's portrait, Woman with Plants, in 1929, and then American Gothic, the positive reinforcement he gets for that style. Critics say, hooray, finally he's painting like an American. This is an American style. It has a severe sense of fact. It is realist. It is linear. It is hard. It is masculine, which, of course, he, you know, adored hearing from the critics.
Sort of the Hemingway equivalent in art or something.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I do think a light bulb went off for him, but I don't think, had he not gotten that kind of positive reinforcement when he came back, he would not have fully adopted this as his mode from that point forward. He really only paints another 12 years between 1930 and his death in 1942. And in many of those years, he paints one canvas or no canvases, or actually panels, I should say, he painted on. But his influences really range then from American folk painting, 16th century altarpieces, works of the Italian Renaissance. He was really an eclectic after abandoning Impressionism.
He started, or at least early on in his career, maybe all the way through, come to think of it, he had these projects that were purely practical, though, I mean, commercial work.
Mm-hmm. He did. He did all sorts of things before he made it as a painter. He was a furniture maker. He was a metal worker. He was a jewelry designer. He began interior decorating for paying clients at 15 and continued to do that well into the 1920s. When he was in the Army, he was a camouflage painter during the First World War. So he had all sorts of directions that his creativity was taking him in the 19-teens and 20s. And I don't think it was clear to him or anyone else what he would become. I think that at a certain point, he really thought he would become a metalworker, a metal designer. Later on, this helped him. He created all of his own frames. He decorated friends' houses. So there is a lot more to him than the side that we see of him as a painter.
How much was sort of a pose, you know, when he says, I'm the plainest kind of fellow you can find. There isn't a single thing I've done or experienced that's been even the least bit exciting. How much of that is Grant Wood trying to pretend to be sort of an Iowa farmer type artist?
I think that's absolutely what that was about. Wood was a smart guy. He was a complex person. He has been sort of portrayed as this two-dimensional farmer painter, largely because that is the image that he projected himself. I think the reasons behind this persona that he adopts, really beginning around the time of American Gothic, is due, first of all, to the fact that there's a lot of suspicion about what happens when painters go to Paris in the 1920s and live a bohemian lifestyle. So part of it is a way of saying, look, you know, I'm still, you know, my morals are still intact. I'm still the small town boy. But I think, you know, in another and a much more critical sense for him, as a closeted gay man, he really needed to create a kind of protective shell around himself. And by saying, there's nothing to see here, it was his way of saying, don't look too closely. Mm-hmm. It was a way of saying, there's really nothing more to me than what you see. And of course, there was so much more to him than what people saw. The secrets ran rather deep, I would say, with him. And it's not just about his closeted sexuality. It has to do with his ambivalence about being home. He loved Iowa, but he was not entirely reconciled with coming back permanently. He loved his family, but of course he had very complicated relationships with his family. So I really think it was a form of camouflage. It was a way of saying there's not much to see here, but it was also, I think, you know, without being too cynical about it, a way to brand himself as an artist. This is who I am and this is what my work is. You're buying the naive work of an unschooled farmer, and nothing could have been further from the truth.
We'll look more closely, nonetheless, at Grant Wood when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Tripp Evans, author of a biography of Grant Wood. We probably, through American Gothic, but through other paintings as well, associate Grant Wood irrevocably with Iowa and, through extension, the Midwest. But you said just a moment ago, Tripp, that he was ambivalent about whether he wanted to return to Iowa. Now, he was in the military. Actually, he volunteered, did he not, for the Army during World War I?
He did. He enlisted and spent the beginning part of his enlistment at Fort Dodge, was transferred to Washington, D.C., where as an artist, he was asked to create camouflage for weapons, for, you know, he made dummy cannons, those kinds of things. But the armistice was signed before he actually saw any kind of active service, and he came back to Cedar Rapids. Wood spent a lot of his teenage years and 20s, I think, trying to find a way out of Iowa. He claimed himself later that he was a disciple of H.L. Mencken and believed that the small towns were filled with nothing but the bourgeoisie of Mencken's columns. He later, in describing this, said, of course, you know, I was young and now I know better and now I'm happy to be home. But I do think that there was a real sense of regret and almost mourning the loss of Paris and his life abroad that had taken him abroad four or five times during the 20s. At one point, for an 18-month stint, he studied at the Académie Julienne, and he clearly reveled in this artistic culture of cities like Munich and Paris. So when he comes home and decides to come home permanently, it is both, I think, in some ways a relief to him. He does love Iowa, and he found in Iowa a kind of endlessly rich source of material for his work. But I do think that he also felt that he did not have the kind of freedom in Cedar Rapids that he did as an anonymous artist living in a foreign city.
It seems like a big American story of the 1920s, doesn't it? I mean, you know, Fitzgerald, yeah. The Midwest, love-hate kind of relationship, and other authors as well, and I would imagine painters, but none of them typifies it more than Grant Wood. This is also a time when as he comes to his maturity, where a lot of people are, I guess, coming back to the United States from that Paris experience. Where does he first become known? I mean, is he making a reputation at all before 1930 when he makes it so big?
He did well at state fairs. It was a big deal. I mean, he actually was winning lots of portrait and landscape prizes at state fairs. He was certainly well known in Cedar Rapids, which had already embraced him early on, largely through his promoter, David Turner, who was also his landlord. Turner owned a funeral home in town and sold Wood's paintings at funeral conventions and was a sort of early promoter for Wood's work. But it really isn't until he hits it big in 1930 with that kind of overnight sensation of American Gothic that he's on anyone's radar.
What do we have for a Grant Wood style leading up to this? I mean, do we see things that, oh, this although done in 1925 or 26, is clearly the work of the man who would paint American Gothic?
It's really bizarre. He paints in a number of different styles in the teens and 20s. You could describe them as strictly academic. The University of Iowa, he'd been taught to paint in a kind of Beaux-Arts way. It's a very sort of 19th century academic style. He paints in an impressionist style. He actually tried abstraction as well. He did a few sort of canvases that were very abstract. So he had a lot of different styles, but nothing that looked like his later mature style. It is with one painting, not his mother's portrait, but a portrait that he starts in 1928 called Portrait of John B. Turner, Pioneer. And it's his landlord's father, John B. Turner. And it's really the first time that Wood both thinks about an Iowan type, in this case a kind of patriarch figure, and a kind of hard, linear, unapologetically realistic style. And it really seems to come almost from nowhere. He paints this very realistic portrait of John Turner with an Iowa map behind him. So it's the first kind of very self-consciously Iowan picture too. And what happens is kind of interesting. He goes to Germany and has this epiphany, and he wants it to be a nice, neat story of, I went to Germany, learned how to paint differently, and came home. Well, of course, John B. Turner's portrait proves that, you know, he actually was beginning to think along these lines. When Wood comes back, he covers the part of the painting that shows the date. He gives it an oval mat and redates it. Says, I didn't paint this in 1928. I painted it in, you know, 1930 when he does American Gothic. So he already is editing his own sort of life story at that point. But it really is a sharp break when you see that one painting and he sort of gets it. And I argue in the book, too, that I think that this is the very first of the kind of surrogate paintings of his father. I think it's his father that ironically leads him to this moment of how he will paint.
You also argue in the book that one reason he may have enjoyed going abroad so much was to get out of the matrimonial pool. Can you talk about that and the sort of pressures on him to marry, to lead what would look like a more conventional life?
Right. Wood was constantly being set up by well-meaning friends who believed it was time he got married.
And didn't know about his homosexuality.
Well, what's funny is I think that the very people who probably guessed it wanted him married off quickly because of that. I mean, there's a lot of tongue-in-cheek references in sort of local columns, the Des Moines Register, Cedar Rapids Gazette, to Wood as a capital B bachelor. People are worried about the fact that he is not married. And they're digs almost at him. So people try to set him up with people. He always claims, I have my mother and my sister, and I can't marry while mother is still alive. I have to take care of.
A famous rationale.
Yeah, exactly. So he hid behind Hattie, and this becomes the way that he avoids matrimony. Later, I think that, you know, Cedar Rapids got so used to the idea of him being this bachelor that when he does shock everyone when he is in his 40s and announces, in fact, the newspaper announced it before a lot of people even knew about this, that he would marry this woman, Sarah Maxson, in 1935. I think it really kind of flipped people out. He felt he had finally done this thing that people expected of him, and yet I think it really surprised people in a way that I think really reveals how well people really knew who he was.
And why Sarah Maxson? What about her?
Sarah is such an interesting character. I think that the marriage happens largely because Hattie is dying. In 1935, it is very clear that the 77-year-old Hattie is not going to be around forever, and it petrifies Wood to imagine life without Hattie. So he meets Sarah at a cocktail party. She had had Cedar Rapids roots herself. She'd been a light opera singer and had been discovered by Jerome Kern and had traveled widely. Their initial dating really revolved around her acting really as a nurse for Hattie. He decides to marry her. Neither Hattie nor Nan was at the wedding. almost no one was at the wedding other than Sarah's son from a previous marriage.
This is because of disapproval or lack of confidence or just not being informed?
No one in Cedar Rapids liked Sarah from the very beginning. And Wood's first bio and only until this point biographer from 1944, Daryl Garwood, put it really well. He said that Cedar Rapids considered Grant Wood a piece of municipal property. He was theirs, and any alteration to this monument that they had sort of erected in their own minds of who he was their prerogative, not his. And in fact, when his inner circle found out that he was engaged, they staged an intervention. They held a dinner party at which he thought he would be congratulated for his upcoming marriage.
But they tried to talk him out of it?
And they tried to talk him out of it. He was humiliated. At the end of this dinner party, they all sat him down and said, you cannot do this thing. And it was partly because not just that he was sort of breaking some kind of contract that he had with the city and his circle, but it was because she was such a strange choice for him to make in their eyes. She was 7 years Wood senior. She was white-haired and matronly and a grandmother, and she looked like Hattie. And I think that's that's at the basis of what really kind of freaked
people out.
Freud
would have a lot of fun, wouldn't he?
Absolutely. So that's sort of why Sarah. I mean, I think that he needed a replacement for Hattie, and he needed a replacement for Hattie quickly. And indeed, Hattie dies within a number of months of the wedding.
And is there actual proof that Grant Wood was gay? In other words, is it just the sort of veiled references and innuendo and so on, or is there, as you were working with the material you had available as his biographer, is there proof?
Well, you know, I never found the Grant Wood diary entry, the letter that, you know, no one had ever seen before. But the notion of Wood's homosexuality was something that critics, contemporaries, neighbors, people writing about his work in the 30s made a point of, however veiled. So there was that. Beyond that, you have the controversy at the University of Iowa in 1941 when his colleagues were trying to get him out of their department. He was kind of loathed by members of his department who saw him as an imposter in the academy. There are meetings, minutes of meetings that happen in the 40-41 period in which it is explicitly stated that due to Wood's relationship with his secretary, Park Reinhard, that there was questions about whether he could continue at the university. And I should add as an aside, the university today fully embraces Wood's legacy there, but it was a tough time for him in 40-41. The closest I've really come to very explicit acknowledgments by someone who knew Wood were the papers of Sarah herself. They are married for 3 years, and she disappears after that, I mean, from his story. Through sheer luck, and once the manuscript had actually been finished, found Sarah's unpublished memoir that was still in the hands of her still-living landlord in Washington State. And Sarah's memoirs really do, I think, put the story to rest. She is fairly explicit about Wood's attraction to and pursuit of her son who came to live with them. She talks sympathetically about his work and compares him to Oscar Wilde. Mm-hmm. She says, why shouldn't the world know all about him? He's a genius. So was Oscar Wilde. And everyone still thinks he's a genius, even though everyone knows all about him. And then she sort of winks to the reader. Mm-hmm. So there are elements like that. Have I found the lost letters, the lost diary entries? No. But there really is no serious scholar working on Wood today who doubts this. I feel like it's a matter that we can put to rest.
What does he say in that unfinished autobiography?
Well, the unfinished autobiography probably unsurprisingly marches right up to the point of his father's death, and it stops.
When he's 10 years old?
His biography stops at the age of 10. And it's so revealing because in Wood's paintings, his mature paintings, he can never get past 1901. He's asked to portray contemporary scenes, and he insistently makes them look sort of archaic, They look like scenes from the 1890s or from the turn of the century. So in his work and in his autobiography, he reaches the point of his father's death, and it is a hurdle he cannot get across. So we don't have a lot in his autobiography of his life beyond the age of 10, but for me, he tells so much even in that brief fragment.
Did he do any self-portraits?
He did. He did a number early on in Paris. We have a great one of him in a Parisian goatee, a pencil drawing at the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art. But the only self-portrait that he painted in his mature style, he started in 1932, I believe, and submitted it to an Iowa Federation of Women's Clubs. They were doing a contest about artist self-portraits. What is revealing about this particular piece is that he takes it back from the exhibition, starts to rework it, changes the clothing, changes the expression, changes the background, reworks it and reworks it and reworks it. It stays in his studio until his death 10 years later. And it's such a fitting metaphor for his inability to really decide on who he was going to project to the world. I mean, quite literally, he cannot finish his own self-portrait.
Some of the photographs that I've seen have him in overalls. Was that sort of a deliberate choice that he made, or did he actually wear overalls a good deal of the time?
It was a deliberate choice, and what's really kind of amazing is that we can date to the year when he started wearing them and when he stopped wearing them. So overalls would have been what he associated, of course, with his father. He grew up as a child wearing overalls, but Nan includes in her own memoirs a story about Wood as a boy. He arrives in Cedar Rapids in overalls, and he is endlessly made fun of for his country dress. So the overalls are banished until 1925, when he is asked to paint workers at the J.G. Cherry dairy plant. And he has to spend hours and hours on the plant floor sketching the workers. And in the 1930s, people don't remember this or maybe know this, but factory workers wore overalls. It wasn't just for farmers. So all of these guys that he's surrounded by who were engaged in demanding masculine physical labor like his father had sort of hoped he would take up himself were wearing overalls. Wood starts wearing overalls. And he initially says he did it to blend in on the plant floor so that he could paint without people noticing him. But he starts wearing it as his everyday uniform. And Iowans found it eccentric. People talk about him wearing these overalls everywhere. And people thought, unless we're working in a factory or a farm, there's no real reason for him to wear them. So they become a trademark for him. They become part of that persona of who I am, a farmer painter, as he called himself. And when John Stuart Curry comes to visit him at the Stone City Art Colony, Curry comes from, Urbane, Connecticut. He arrives, first thing Wood does is give him his own pair of overalls to wear, and Curry obligingly puts them on. But in 1935, when he marries Sarah, Sarah was a clothes horse. And Sarah essentially takes him aside and says, if you don't stop wearing overalls, I will scream because I cannot wear flowing silk hostess pajamas with you in overalls. So he stops actually wearing them in the mid-30s, and she tells him it's time to embrace yourself as a celebrity, as a regional painter. You are an important Iowan. And she gives him a lot of confidence. People really give Sarah a hard time, but I think that she actually helped Wood out a lot. And I think that she was fully aware from the beginning of their marriage who he was. And yet to her, other things were important.
I get the impression from something you said earlier, Tripp, that once he was at Iowa, University of Iowa, there was a fair amount of professional jealousy behind the scenes. Nobody really wanted to have much to do with him in the department. But what about Iowans in general? These images that are starting to become world famous.
Right.
Do Iowans take those in a positive light or a negative light?
Well, there was an initial reticence when American Gothic came out because I think that there was a fear that he was out to make fun of Iowans. he immediately puts this to rest. And I think and certainly those who knew him in Cedar Rapids and knew who he was, what a sort of decent kind of home-loving guy they knew him to be anyway, that he was really on the side of Iowans. So you find someone like the poet Don Farron said that Wood has finally put Iowa in long pants, meaning that he has heralded the state's artistic arrival. So he was important to Iowans who wanted to believe that finally, you know, we have this national cultural figure who is important all over the world, you know, and he really was on a kind of international kind of map in 1930 that could sort of stand for Iowans and stand for the kind of depth of Iowan, you know, culture. So I think absolutely there's this divide between Iowans on the one side who adored him and saw him as their champion, and then his colleagues at the University of Iowa who thought, here's a guy with a high school diploma whose teaching career consisted of teaching seventh graders, suddenly a tenured professor among their ranks. So the Des Moines Register says, you know, it is gladdening to know that Wood is not without recognition in his homeland. But of course, his colleagues were thinking the absolute opposite and couldn't wait to get rid of him.
More on Grant Wood when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
In 1942, Thomas Hart Benton said, "When this war is over, a new and better America, whipped into shape by sacrifice and hardened by a rebirth of male will, is going to rise. When this new America looks back for landmarks to help gauge its forward footsteps, it will find a monument standing up in the midst of the wreckage. Twisted and broken, the refuse of America's pre-war decadence will lie all about. The monument rising out of it will shine with the light of a strong and personal cultural identity. This monument will be made out of Grant Wood's works."
That's a remark by Thomas Hart Benton talking about Grant Wood that's included in the book Grant Wood, A Life, by our guest Tripp Evans. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Well, was Thomas Hart Benton right? In other words, after Grant Wood's death, did he become sort of this monument of American culture?
Well, unfortunately for the still living Benton, who is his closest regionalist comrade, it could not have been further from the truth. In fact, within 24 hours of Wood's death, the New York Times ran an editorial declaring that regionalism had died even before Wood had. And it really plays out over the next couple of decades that the critical fortune of the work of the so-called regionalist triumvirate, Benton, John Stuart Curry, and Grant Wood, is really almost immediately eclipsed by new movements. Among them, abstract expressionism becomes the new American movement that is heralded. And you get into the 1950s and certainly the 1960s, no one wanted to touch Grant Wood or any of the regionalists with, you know, a 10-foot pole. They really fall off the radar.
Because they were seen as conservative? Or what was it that made the sort of backlash against them?
Well, the backlash was critics. I think a lot of modernist critics were just eager to sort of bury the movement to begin with. But I think that there were other elements too. I think that the regionalist movement bore a superficial but a kind of unfortunate kind of affinity with Soviet realist work of the 1930s. And what happens as the Cold War really ramps up is that painters like Jackson Pollock and others are heralded as the champions of American free expression. And in fact, Francis Saunders has written about this. There was actually kind of covert CIA support for abstract expressionism in the 50s. And so I think part of it is the fact that it is seen as very conservative. And certainly during the Cold War, it starts to look an awful lot like the kind of realism in under sort of non-democratic societies. I think by the 60s, people really could not be bothered with anything that smacked of folksiness, at least in this sense. And it's not really until the dawn of the Reagan era. It's really the 1980s when Wood starts coming back into his own. And he's been more or less, I think, a sort of constant in the canon since then. But I think that it's not coincidence that when Reagan talked about his morning in America, that suddenly Wood's work hit a nerve again.
Give us some sense of the subject matter of Grant Wood's. I mean, we think, of course, American Gothic, and we think of some of those, I'll call them severe faces.
Mm-hmm.
And also we have pictures of rolling hills and crops. What about action pictures?
Well, he did paint in a variety of different genres. So portraits, genre scenes, gorgeous landscapes. He also painted history paintings, which could be seen as action paintings. The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere.
Oh, really?
In the early 30s. But he gets all of the facts wrong. There's no signaling light. You can't really see Paul Revere. It's an odd painting. He does Parson Weems' Fable in 1939, which I think is maybe my favorite Grant Wood.
Is that the one with the cherry tree being cut down?
It's Washington chopping down his father's cherry tree.
Very retro themes so far. Paul Revere, George Washington.
American history.
In fact, really, George Washington kind of Parson Weems, which is fictitious in itself. Yeah.
Absolutely. And it becomes even stranger when he places on the six-year-old Washington's head a perfect replica of Gilbert Stuart's mature portrait of him that's on the dollar bill. And he does it sort of as a joke. He took some flack for it. So history painting, I think, was important for him also to place himself in the kind of genealogy of great American painters.
Do we see modern stuff? I mean, like, there's one painting, actually it's on the cover of your book, come to think of it, of what shapes up to be pretty clearly a terrifying automotive occurrence.
That painting, it's called Death on the Ridge Road, and he painted it in 1935. It shows a sedan passing another car on a narrow country road, and coming around the corner is a red delivery truck that is about to have a head-on collision with the sedan.
And there's a storm off to one corner,
and there's a storm off to the side, and the telephone poles that are kind of jackknifed all around them look for all the world like the scene of, you know, Christ's crucifixion. I mean, there's three cross-shaped poles, and there is a lot of religious imagery in Wood's work. Death on the Ridge Road is a rare example of Wood engaging with the contemporary world. It really is an unusually immediate and contemporary kind of image, and it very much is an action shot. But what's interesting about it is the collision is forestalled. We're left, you know, on the edge of our seat, biting our nails.
It's ambiguous
looking at this.
Again. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And the crash never happens. So you're not looking at the great pow. You're looking at the, right before it happens.
The moment of recognition.
And it's why I was so glad when my editor chose it for the cover, because I couldn't, you can't imagine a more, perfect illustration of Wood's life itself. I mean, I think Wood spent much of his life just about to crash, and it would be averted.
Literally, he was a lousy driver, right?
And he was a lousy driver. Mostly, he had people drive him around, and he actually designed a little wooden dingbat, one of those pointing hands, that when he turned, he sort of pulled it out and kind of waved it.
His turn signal?
It was his turn signal, exactly. So people around town knew to stay away from Wood when he was driving.
As his biographer, what effect would you say kind of being in his head or in the lives of people who knew him? You know how you read about some biographers who actually put themselves in the biography or somehow become influenced by the subject that they've spent so long researching. Any effect that you've noticed of Grant Wood on you where you come away feeling something toward him? Are you irritated by him? Do you admire him? Do you pity him?
Are you vindicating him?
It's going to sound strange considering how open I am about things that he was very secretive about. I actually feel protective about him in a strange way. I think at different points of his life in which you can see him about to make some hideous mistake or is humiliated, for example, in this, the dinner party that we were talking about, I find myself wanting to save him and wanting to say, don't do that. Don't go in there. So I came to be extraordinarily fond of him. And I don't think I was in the beginning. I think in the beginning I was very much thinking, who is this cynical person who's sort of branding himself in this particular particular way. And once you really get to know Grant Wood, and that's what I hope people will do when they read this book, and you see the kind of complex person he was, there is this impulse to want to make it right for him.
To protect him from the bad reviews and nasty critics and so on.
Exactly.
What about his importance to art? You know, in other words, had there been no Grant Wood, what would we miss?
That's a great question. I really believe that Wood is one of the most important American painters of the 20th century. And the reason for that is not just that he was able to find a voice with his region and with his sort of immediate, you know, family, but because of the way that he did it. It wasn't just that he created these gorgeous landscapes and wonderful history paintings and disturbing portraits, but the fact that he invested, I think consciously and unconsciously, so much of what was going on beneath the surface. They are extraordinary records of the way that creativity functions and the way that creativity intersects with biography. So I think quite unlike his regionalist comrades, Thomas Hart Benton and John Stuart Curry, because his paintings are not so straightforward, they become, to me, sort of documents about how do you hide in plain sight? How do you reconcile the world before 1901 and the deeply modern world of the 1930s? And I think that his works display all of those tensions that people generally, I think, felt in the 30s and that Wood specifically felt in terms of the tensions of his own life. So to me, they're remarkable documents about how an artist struggles with these various demons and very successfully.
Tripp Evans has been our guest for this hour. He's the author of Grant Wood, A Life. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 for charming conversation with a man who has been playing the piano since 1920 and still concertizes. His name, Frank Glaser. Join us for the music and the conversation with Frank Glaser right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.